What do we know about Muhammad as a child?
Great question. So our knowledge about Muhammad's entire life, including his childhood, is based principally on Islamic sources. So that's the first point, right? When we think about the Prophet Muhammad, we are viewing him through the lens of later Muslim scholars. So that's an important point. Now, many academics would say that we are on firmer ground historically in the latter period of Muhammad's life. So Muhammad's life is sometimes divided between the Meccan period and when he's in Mecca, which is from his birth until the year 622, in the Medinan period when he's in the city of Medina, between 622 and 632. So scholars would often say, oh, in the Medinan period, we have more trust because people recognize his position and would have recorded his actions in words more carefully. So there's a lot of skepticism about what we can actually know about Muhammad as a child. Muslims, especially religious Muslims, would be more confident about that. So, but let me say a couple of things just to follow the traditional story. So by tradition, he's born in the year AD 570. In Islamic sources, this is known as the year of the elephant because it's the year during which a ruler from the southern part of Arabia attacked Mecca with an elephant. So this is how the year is often marked and recorded. He was born in the year of the elephant, which modern scholars often calculate to the year 570. And by tradition, he was an orphan. And so most reports say that his father, Abdullah, died before he was born. And his mother, Amina, died when he was very young. And so he was put into the care of different people as a child. First, while Amina was still alive, he was taken care of by a foster mother, a woman named Halima, which I could speak about more. Then he was put in the care of various people, starting with his grandfather, who was named Abdul Muttalib, who was sort of the religious leader before Muhammad started preaching Islam in the city of Mecca. And then his uncle, who was Abu Talib. And he's said to have gone on trading journeys with his uncle Abu Talib to travel to Syria, for example, and back. Maybe I'll stop there.
So I noticed that you kept emphasizing from tradition and maybe different. I mean, maybe tradition, and then there is, I think, the historian community, maybe, or maybe people, or scholarly community.
Exactly.
Can you just elaborate a little bit on, or if you can give us an idea of how much agreement there is between these traditional people who follow the traditional route and maybe people who study this on a scholarly basis, how much overlap there is, how much disagreement there is per se. Yeah.
Yes. So there is significant difference in the approach to the biography of the Prophet Muhammad between sort of the academic community and traditional Islamic communities. So this is not to say that either group is monolithic. There is diversity and difference within each group as well. But as a rule, Muslims are confident that we can know a lot about the Prophet's life. They would point to certain methods or techniques within traditional Islamic historical scholarship, which assures the reliability of certain accounts about Muhammad's life. So they would say, well, these accounts have passed down through an unbroken chain of oral tradition and therefore reliable. For example, they would say on the early Meccan period of Muhammad's life, we can trust that Muslim scholars working in the 8th or 9th century remembered what happened between the years 570, the years that followed 570. So they would say, okay, it's true that some accounts may be inauthentic. And you have, for example, some modernist Muslim scholars who are skeptical about miracle accounts. So all sorts of miracle stories told about Muhammad. And there is a rationalizing trend among some religious Muslims who would say, yeah, supernatural miracles, okay, we can sort of set these aside and deal with the more sober accounts about Muhammad's life. So that would be one trend within Muslim tradition. And then people would rebuke them, sort of respond saying, no, God can work miracles. We have no right to sort of distinguish between what we find to be reasonable and what we find to be unreasonable. So that's probably enough for now to say about the traditional Islamic community. But the academic community would say, Well, even those accounts that the Islamic tradition considers reliable because of the technique of oral transmission and the list of authorities who report those traditions, even if Islamic tradition places great trust in that, there's still reason to be skeptical. I mean, I'll just give a couple reasons that academic scholars often point to. One is that these lists of authorities or the technique of verifying accounts develops gradually in Islamic historical tradition, if that makes sense. And so there's an idea that these sort of lists of authorities and techniques were a response to an awareness that there was a problem. And so Islamic tradition sort of intervened at a certain point and said, okay, let's try to figure out what's authentic, what's inauthentic. And then a second point is a lot of the accounts of Muhammad's life seem to be, to use a very fancy word, what scholars would call exegetical. That means they tend to be connected to something in the Quran. Even the account of Muhammad being an orphan is related to a passage in the Quran. And scholars would say, okay, what came first? Was it Muhammad really being an orphan, and then the Quran speaks about this? Or were scholars reading the Quran, they saw a reference to someone being an orphan, and they said, Muhammad must have been an orphan. And this plays out in many different accounts of Muhammad's life. For example, in his childhood, there's a story of two angels coming and opening up his chest and removing an impurity from his heart. And that seems to be connected to a passage in Quran, chapter 94. So scholars would say, okay, did this account really happen and the Quran speaks about it? Or did someone read this passage of Quran 94 and then write the story of Muhammad's chest being opened? So those are some of the reasons why Western scholars sometimes have some questioning and doubts about a lot of the accounts connected with Prophet Muhammad. So there's significant difference. Having said that, last thing, even among Western scholars, there are different positions. So some are more, I use another fancy word, what scholars call sanguine, that is more trusting, and some are more skeptical.
I'm a little curious about this oral tradition. I mean, to my knowledge, I think, in India, where I'm from, I think most of the Mahabharata, so the mythologies of India, like Mahabharata, Ramayana, the Hindu mythologies per se, so they were recorded orally. I think before they were written down for a large period of time, they were recorded orally. And I think there is, I don't know about the scholarly consensus, but I mean, there is some, I don't know. I feel like, those have been passed down pretty, there is an argument that those have been passed down pretty faithfully. I'm not very sure about, the point that I'm trying to make is, is this unique to Muhammad where, oral tradition, where a lot of the story is coming down orally, where I think, or is it for Jesus and for Buddha, where did you have like written documents during their time itself? And I'm so sorry for the, great. It's a great, I'm
all over the place. Great question. So I can't comment on Hinduism because I don't know the Hindu tradition well. I can comment on a sort of comparative examination of the sources for Jesus's life and Muhammad's life. Is that okay? Should I say one or two things?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So they're very different cases. And considering the historical Jesus and the historical Muhammad needs to be attentive to the nature of the documents and the authorities behind the documents in each case. So with Muhammad, I mean, starting with the later figure with Muhammad, we have the benefit of a very early source, which is the Quran. So there's good reason to think the Quran comes together very soon after the Prophet's life. And I could enter into those arguments. The problem, however, is that the Quran is a very elusive, vague document in terms of historical details. So, for example, it mentions Muhammad by name only four times. A fifth time, it refers to him with a different name, Ahmad. So, and it tends to not give precise places, precise times. It doesn't refer to the contemporaries of Muhammad, with the exception of two figures, that's Zayd and Abu Lahab, by name, doesn't refer to them by name. So we have this early source, but it's pretty vague. So even if it comes, let's say, 20 years after the Prophet's death, which is quite early in historical terms, it's vague. And then we have the historical sources in Islam, which are amazingly detailed, speak about everything from the beginning to the end of Muhammad's life. But as I mentioned before, they're quite late. So they come together at the very end of the 8th century. So at least 150 years after Muhammad's life. So that's problematic, this gap in time. Okay, with the case of Jesus, totally different situation. The Gospels probably come together, the first Gospel, according to scholarly consensus. I mean, there's some doubts about this, but most scholars would go for Mark as the first Gospel, which probably comes together before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70. So probably sometime in the 60s. So a little bit later, 30 years after Jesus' death. But Mark is pretty detailed. The Gospels are not like the Quran. They give accounts and they give detailed accounts of Jesus, as your listeners may know. So in some ways, you're on a little bit better ground for working on the historical Jesus, also because you have the four different sources that can be compared with each other. That is the four Gospels. Plus, we do have outside non-Christian sources, most notably a Jewish historian known as Flavius Josephus, who writes also in the first century. It's a very different situation. Some scholars might make the case that you're actually on better ground with Muhammad because they have more confidence in those later Islamic sources. My assessment is that in terms of getting to historical details of someone's life, we're in better territory with Jesus.
So I'm just curious in the sense that, why do you think, you mentioned, I think for Jesus, I think the first gospel was written, if I'm not wrong, by Mark, and that was 30 years after Jesus' death. And I think for Muhammad, it was almost two centuries after which you get a decent picture of those accounts, if I'm not wrong. Did I understand that right?
Yes.
So why do you think that is? I mean, it just boggles my mind that it's such an important figure that people did not, I mean, and that too, 7 centuries after Jesus. I mean, in the sense that I'm sure writing would have progressed a little further. Yeah, so there would be more people writing stuff. So why do you think that people didn't bother to write, at least his friends or, you know, family or some close, he had multiple followers. So wasn't there one fanatic or one crazy follower who just blogged about him every day or something like that?
Yeah. So that's a really great question. Why do we not have sources from the 7th and early 8th century about Muhammad's life? Now, some scholars would say that we do. And maybe it's worth entering a little bit more detail about the nature of the Islamic historical sources from the late 8th, early 9th century. So these first sources, so the most famous figure is named Ibn Ishaq, who's, okay, let me start from the end. So the first detailed biography of Muhammad is written down by someone named Ibn Hisham, who dies, I believe, in the year 833, AD 833. So, almost exactly 200 years. His death is almost exactly 200 years after the death of Muhammad, 201 years. So now, Ibn Hisham cites an earlier scholar as the source for most of his work, and that earlier scholar is someone named Ibn Ishaq. Ibn Ishaq dies in 767, so we're getting closer. We don't have anything written by Ibn Ishaq, so one could suspect that changes have taken place between the time that Ibn Ishaq wrote his apparently lost work and Ibn Hisham. But the story gets more interesting because Ibn Ishaq actually quotes earlier sources. So you have sort of a chain, if that makes sense. So he'll refer to someone named Az-Zuhri, who is a Syrian historian who dies around the year 740. And even sometimes earlier figures, so he'll sort of give a chain. I know from Zuhri who heard from someone else, and their other names, it'll get complicated if we mention all the names. So it's possible that people were writing things down, and just those original sources are lost to us. I find myself a little skeptical about that. I suspect that most of those earlier sources were just oral authorities, teachers telling students. I think that there was an oral culture that was valued in the first decades after of Islamic society, in which the culture of historical writing simply hadn't developed. And it's possible that it was only later through the influence of other societies, Jews, Christians, the Byzantine society, that is especially in what's known as the Abbasid period, which starts in 750, that you just have a cultural phenomenon where all sorts of literature begins. And this happens in the Abbasid period after 750. So this is when you have the first commentaries on the Quran, when you have the first grammatical books being written down. I mean, all of Islamic literature blossoms at this time. So yeah, maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Is there a... So I was raised a Catholic, so I'm a little more familiar with the Catholic tradition than Islamic. But I think in Catholic tradition, I think Jesus gets a bit of a myth building when he was young. I mean, I think there will be stories about, I think, him going visiting the Jerusalem temple and him trying to debate all these scholars. And I think there are a few miracles as well. I'm not a believer, so I don't know too much about it as well. But is there a sense of myth building with Prophet Muhammad? I mean, where there might be stories about him being quote unquote the one, and you know, per se.
Okay, so yeah, there's definitely a process. Great point. There's definitely a process of myth making in the life of Muhammad as it's recorded in the Islamic sources. You know, there are different approaches to the miraculous stories, the supernatural stories around Muhammad. I mean, there are stories, for example, of, you know, we have the stories, some of the stories seem to be modeled on Jesus's miracles. So, or Moses's miracles. So Jesus, for example, feeds the multitudes with fish and loaves of bread. There are stories of Muhammad doing more or less the same thing. There are stories of him providing water in the desert through his fingertips. The water flows from his fingertips. There are stories of him calling out to a tree, which sort of walks across the ground towards him. The most famous story that may be connected to something in the Quran has him travel on a flying horse named Buraq from Mecca to Jerusalem in back in one night. So there are lots of stories like this. Muslim scholars have different approaches to them. As I mentioned a bit earlier, there's some scholars who have a rationalizing trend. This shows up in different thinkers. For example, the Quran translator, Muhammad Asad, who was in Pakistan. He's actually a European, converted to Islam, and was in Pakistan in the early period of the foundation of the Pakistani state. He's a rationalizer who basically wants to demythologize these accounts. Other Muslims are like that. And then there are people who respond to it, like Sayyid Qutb,
can you elaborate a little bit on what do you mean by rationalizer?
Yeah, so basically Muhammad Asad, while not denying the divine origin of the Quran, would say, properly understood, the Quran itself does not refer to any supernatural miracles. And therefore, the stories, the supernatural miracles associated with Muhammad in the other traditions should be basically set aside. And Muhammad should be seen as a prophet of God who did receive messages from God, but not as a miracle worker. And then there are responses to these rationalizers who deny miracles by people like Sayyid Qutb, a major figure in Europe who was killed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, I believe, in 1966, who Sayyid Qutb is like, I understand why you guys are rationalizing, like you're concerned that people will be superstitious or whatever. But we believe that God is all powerful. He can intervene. And if our sources and traditions tell us supernatural miracles, then why not? Let's accept them. This is an important debate within Islam. Again, Western scholars would sometimes be skeptical not only of the supernatural accounts, but even of the more sober, everyday accounts of Muhammad's life. So that's a major question within Islam and also within the Western academic community.
So on the supernatural accounts, right? Like let's say with Jesus maybe multiplying whatever number of bread and fish and whatever. How do the historical community evaluate the supernatural? I mean, how do the academic community look at these, maybe in terms of Jesus, Buddha, or the Prophet, when they have these, you know, you mentioned that winged horse story. I think I've heard that one before, I think, in a head-to-head episode with Richard Dawkins. How do the academic community evaluate the supernatural events or occurrences?
Yeah, so, I mean, the the Western scholarship is completely divided over the biography of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, there, if I mean, famously, early Orientalists tended to see Muhammad as a figure who was born, according to the French scholar Ernest Renan, he said, Islam was born in the full light of history. And he was very skeptical of the authority of the Gospels for Jesus' life. And he thought that we could know all sorts of things about Muhammad. He was not a Muslim, and he had some critical things to say about Muhammad, but he felt that in historical terms, we could know a lot about Muhammad. So that was sort of the trend until in the late 19th century, scholars began to scrutinize the techniques of Islamic historical transmission. Most famously, a Hungarian scholar by the name of Ignaz Goldzier, Goldzier, G-O-L-D-Z-I-H-E-R, who said, you know, even the accounts that Muslim scholars hold to be perfectly authentic, multiply transmitted, when we actually evaluate them, we see contradictions, we see anachronisms, we see stuff that's clearly dependent on material in the Quran. So there's all sorts of reasons to be skeptical of it. So, I mean, sometimes this leads to what I see as excessive skepticism, people doubting the existence of Muhammad completely. That is not tenable because in addition to the Quran, we do have Christian and some Jewish accounts from the 7th century, which, while not giving any details of Muhammad's life, they do mention a prophet who came with the invading Arabs. So most famously, there's a text called the Doctrina Jacobi, which is a Greek text, probably from the late 630s, so very, very early. It doesn't say anything about Muhammad, but it does say a prophet has come with the invading forces into Palestine. So, I mean, his historical existence is to me beyond all doubt. So that is excessive to doubt that there was a man named Muhammad who led this movement. And on the other hand, there are some Western scholars who are very, very optimistic. They're sort of, people would use the phrase positivistic. They tend to have a lot of trust in sources and believe that we can get to a solid historical kernel of the Islamic traditions, which would allow us to say a lot of things about Muhammad. I find myself somewhere in the middle.
What is the significance of the fact that the prophet could not read?
Well, that begs the question whether he could read.
you think he could read?
Yes, I think absolutely he could read. Definitely read and probably write. So you're right to ask the question because that is certainly Islamic teaching that Muhammad was illiterate. That teaching is based on a term that appears in the Quran, which is ummi, U-M-M-I, which is understood to mean illiterate. There are all sorts of reasons to doubt this notion. First is the way the Quran uses the word ummi. It also uses the term ummiyun, which is the plural, so the ummis. It speaks of Muhammad preaching to a society which is made up of the ummiyun, the ummis. It speaks of ummis among other people as well. And it's pretty clear that to me, based on the Quran, that this term is never used in the context of writing. It's used in the context of distinguishing between Jews and Christians on one hand and non-Jews and Christians on the other hand. So the Arabs, maybe the Gentiles, people who have never received a scripture before. Some people like to translate this as unscriptured. There are also some sort of historical reasons to doubt that Muhammad was illiterate. One is that Arabic writing did exist at the time. We have all sorts of inscriptions from the 6th century already in what people call Paleo-Arabic, so an early form of Arabic. So Arabic writing was around. And there's every reason to think that urban Arabian society of 6th and 7th century, maybe not the Bedouins, but urban society was a literate society. The prevalence of these inscriptions suggests that this was a literate society. And so it's very likely that the prophet could read and write. But definitely read. Writing maybe is sort of a next step historically. So, and then finally, just the notion that he couldn't read or write is sort of part of Islamic apologetics or arguments in defense of Islam, because it's developed and emphasized in order to make the case that Muhammad could only have known things from God because he couldn't have been reading books. So one can see sort of a convenient reason for this doctrine.
But but even if he could not read, he could have got those stories from maybe travels, etc., right? Like, isn't that, you gave the argument that, the Islamic traditionalist might put the argument that because he did not read, every word that he said was from God. But that may not be the only reason, right? I mean, he could have got these stories from maybe travels or maybe ancestors, or isn't that possible, right?
Right. So that's a common idea, that there were monotheists in his environment. So there were Jews and Christians around. And so why does the Quran speaking about so many biblical stories from Adam to Abraham to Moses to Jesus and Mary? Perhaps because there were Jews and Christians around who were telling these stories. Some people look at the biography of the prophet and say, oh, well, there was, for example, someone named Waraqa, who was a Christian in Mecca, who used to read and write the Bible. So maybe he was a source or something. I'm sort of careful about that because I have some doubts about those reports. That's a common idea. Now, it's worth noting that the Quran itself responds to a charge that Muhammad had an informant. In Quran chapter 16, verse 103, it speaks of an accusation against Muhammad that he had an informant for his ideas and revelations, and it rejects that. It says, oh, this person whom you're referring to speaks a foreign language, and whereas the Quran is in a pure Arabic. That's a common idea, that there are other people around that Muhammad could have learned things from. Of course, Muslims would build arguments defending the traditional claim, saying that, no, there weren't really Jews or Christians in Mecca, and so he could have only got this from God.
I know we are close to 30 minutes. I'll stop in 4 or 5 minutes. Is that okay?
Good. Great.
Yeah. What were the reactions of his family and friends to his revelations?
Islamic tradition tells the story that Muhammad was already married when he had his first experience of revelation. He was married to a woman named Khadija, who was older than him and who was beloved by Muhammad. He never married a second wife as long as he was married to Khadija. And she plays a very important role, because the story is that when he has the first visit of the angel Gabriel, traditionally dated to the year AD 610, he seems to have been in doubt of the nature of the experience. And Khadija sort of comforts him and confirms his experience of revelation. And although we don't hear much about Khadija subsequently, the assumption is that, you know, her affirmation of revelation amounted to an acceptance of Islam. She refers to her cousin Waraqa, so sort of an in-law, who also, who also affirms his prophetic experience. And then there's one other person from Muhammad's family who's really important. And this is his paternal uncle, whose name is Abu Talib, the father of Ali, who's so important to Shia Islam. Abu Talib never becomes a Muslim, but he sees the, according to Islamic accounts, the sincerity of Muhammad and respects it, and so defends Muhammad from his adversaries among the pagans. Until his dying day, Abu Talib is there to defend Muhammad and forms an important part of the Islamic story of the way that the community survived persecution.
Final question. Can you speak to the nature of Prophet Muhammad's relationship with his first wife, Khadija?
Great. Yeah, so I alluded to this a bit, but I could expand on it more. Khadija is a really important figure for all Muslims. In a special way, she's an important figure for Shia Muslims because Muhammad and Khadija are the parents of Fatima, and Fatima will marry Ali, Muhammad's cousin. And from there comes the line of imams that are so precious to the Shia. But Khadija is seen as someone who recognized, even before Muhammad's call to prophethood, his virtues. And this is important for Muslims. There's sort of a debate about whether did God choose Muhammad simply out of divine will, or did Muhammad have such virtuous qualities that God recognized these and chose him for prophethood. Either position you take, still Muslims would affirm that Muhammad had virtuous qualities even before his prophethood, and Khadija is recognized sort of for her ability and insightfulness to see these. She trusted Muhammad before their marriage with her business. She's said to have been a wealthy merchant. And then an important point already mentioned, but worth emphasizing, is that Muhammad never married another woman while he was married to Khadija. And when Khadija passed away, he did have multiple wives. And it's said that Aisha, his beloved wife, the daughter of Abu Bakr, would comment on how frequently, even after her death, Muhammad would speak about Khadija because of his enduring affection for her.
I think on that note, Gabriel, thank you so much for taking the time. It was wonderful having you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy to be with you, Ryan.